sure wish somebody would come and ease my troubling mind. Oh,
and you are listening to CKLN. This is the online edition of Saturday Morning Live, and we're getting ready to have a discussion on retired auto workers. And I have in the studio Bill Devine. Can you hear me?
And I can hear you.
Can you hear me, Mr.? And we also have on the line General Gordon Baker from Detroit. And General Gordon Baker is a retired auto worker from Ford Motor Company, and you are also a founding member of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, and are also a founding member of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America. And we also have in the studio Bill Devine, who is a retired he's retired from General Motors. He's with a van plant in Scarborough in 1995, and he was a member, or still is, I guess, a member of the CAW. And prior to working at GM, he worked at CCM Canada, Cycle and Motor Company, and was a member of the UAW there. He was born in Hamilton, Ontario, and lived in Toronto since 1956. And General Gordon Baker, you were born in Detroit, Michigan.
That's right. Uh-huh.
And your roots are from Georgia. Your father was born, senior was born in Georgia, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. Father and mother.
Uh-huh. All right. I guess we wanted to begin this discussion with a discussion about the whole question of retiring. retiring from the auto plants. This is for both of you. Why should a retiree get a pension paid for by the taxpayers? You know, that's some of the right-wing people, and the state is basically saying that they really don't deserve it, that they're cutting people off. I wanted to get Bill to answer that question first, then General.
Okay.
I would say there are two main reasons why retirees deserve a public pension. And here, what we're talking about here, as far as Canada is concerned, is the old age security pension and the guaranteed income supplement, which is linked to the old age security. These are universal pensions available to everyone at age 65, provided certain residency requirements are met. Now, they're paid out of taxes, unlike the Canada Pension Plan, another plan, which is a contributory plan. Now, about taxpayers' expense, the fact is that retirees have paid their taxes during their working life. Just as each generation that has gone before has paid its taxes. And as a matter of fact, retirees continue to pay taxes on their retirement income. So when retirement comes, retirees have paid their dues. They have a right. And secondly, each generation has made its contribution to the building up of the country. This provides an expanded heritage and an expanded economy for the succeeding generations. So pensioners have done their part. They have a right. Pension is not charity. It's a right, and it's earned during the working life of the pensioner. That would be my answer to the question.
And how do you weigh in on that, General?
A couple of ways. First of all, I stand solidly with what Bill has said. Secondly, we're faced up here in Michigan with people that are attempting to tax all pensions, whether they're public or private, that ain't never been done before. And what I always try to lean back on is to have people have some kind of understanding of how we got pensions in the first place. You know, pensions was nothing that was given to us. I'm a Ford worker, and I came out of the Ford Rouge complex. And back when the Ford was organized by the UAW, in 1941, even though it had been in existence since 1911. Workers never got pensions until 1949. So we had all of those years that the corporations got away with working people till they died and never had to give up a dime. It was the struggle that came pretty much out of foundry workers at the Rouge. At the Rouge plant had about 85,000 employees in 41. About 17,000 of those were black workers that were confined to the foundries and open hearth. And the studies that they done on the old east side of Detroit, which was called Black Bottom, was that Ford workers were dying from pneumonia at four times the rate of the average employee. That from tuberculosis, they were dying at three times the rate of the average employer, mainly because they was concentrated in the foundry and the open hearth unit. So that became a cry in the unionizing drive to get people to unionize, and it became a cry all the way from 1941 to 1948 and 49 before they were able to get a pension in Ford Motor Company. So we had thousands of workers that went to their graves that didn't have no pension. You know, we had workers that come off of work after a hard day's work, sat down on a streetcar, and never got up. They left the widows and children of those workers who just proceeded to try to get a decent day's work and had no way to live. The GM workers got pension in the United States in 1950, and the Chrysler workers took a 104-day strike in 1950 under the cry of too old to work and too young to die in order to get pensions. So I always like to start off by letting people know the price that we paid to get pensions. Our pensions were paid for before we got it. They were paid for by the workers that went to their graves and couldn't help themselves. The wealth that these corporations made and society as a whole benefit from came off of those that went before us. And therefore, our pension is a right that we have already won, and we don't plan to let nobody touch it. So that's my take on this question of why we got a right for a pension.
And you're listening to Saturday Morning Live. We are on www.ckln.fm. Bill Devine is in the studio. General Gordon Baker Jr. is on the line from Detroit, Michigan. And I wanted to pose the next question to Bill and General. First, I wanted to get Mr. Devine to answer this question, both of you to answer this question. Why are governments so grudgingly, why are they so stingy when it comes to increasing the income of workers? Bill.
Okay. Let me just say, first of all, that those were telling points from our friend in Detroit. I think they could be echoed up here in Canada, and there are points that need to be said. Okay, why are governments so stingy when it comes to increasing pension income? Again, I think there are two main reasons. But just to be fair for a moment, in 1980, senior poverty rates were double those of the working age population. By 2004, senior poverty rates had dropped to half the rates of the working age population. So things had improved. This is no doubt due to increases in the old age security pension and the guaranteed income supplement and pension from the Canada Pension Plan. And perhaps a little later we can come back to the Canada Pension Plan.
Mm-hmm.
But pension income is still not enough, because currently there are 4.5 million pensioners on the old age security. Of this number, fully 1.6 million, more than a third, need the additional guaranteed income supplement. And some estimates have said that there are 750,000 pensioners below the poverty level. So why is government not rushing in to improve the situation? And I'm thinking here mainly of the Harper government. Mind, other governments are not without fault. And after our election on May 2nd, maybe we won't have a Harper government. But for the moment, the Harper government's approach is what we have. And that approach loves to promote registered retired savings plans, or RRSPs, which are individually purchased and investment directed, as the best solution to having sufficient pension income on retirement. Now, these RRSPs are managed at a lucrative fee by banks and other financial institutions. So a cynic, if you will, might say that Harper and his government promote RRSPs in order to benefit his friends at the banks and other financial institutions. And I must confess, I am one such a cynic. Okay. More so, given his reduction of corporate income tax. But I think there is something even more fundamental involved here, and I brought along a couple of references which I think make the point. First, a short quote from a 1974 book, The Final Plateau, by Professor Daniel J. Baum. He discusses government inaction prior to the first Old Age Pension Act in 1927. And I quote, "Fundamentally," he says, "the federal government chose not to act purely on the grounds of principle. The federal policy seemed to be that Canadians should be encouraged to save for themselves and so provide for their old age. It ought not to be the function of government to meet the demands of its older citizens. So what Canadians were forced with then in 1927 was an ideological mindset which favored private over public, and which told workers that if they didn't on their own set aside enough money for their retirement, they had either been spendthrift or lazy. But that was then, back in 1927. Now is now, and surely government doesn't still feel that way. Well, yes, it does. In 2009, Conservative MP Ted Menzies, Parliamentary Secretary to Finance Minister Jim Flaherty at the time, chaired a series of Canada-wide pension consultation meetings on possible pension reform. A much-discussed reform was for an expanded Canada pension plan or something supplemental to it, and whether any such reform should be compulsory or voluntary. Now, reporting on this on June the 1st, 2009, the Globe and Mail stated, Globe and Mail newspaper in Toronto, quote, "Mr. Menzies is still not certain there's a problem that needs fixing, and he's not keen on any mandatory expansion of retirement savings that would compel Canadians and employers to contribute more, saying that strikes him, quote, as a bit of a nanny state situation," unquote. So from 1927, when in principle it ought not to be the function of government to meet the demands of the of its older citizens, to now, when better public pensions are seen by Harperites as a bit of a nanny state situation. Different wording, same message, and same ideological mindset as in 1927, private over public, which I believe explains government promotion of private RRSPs rather than improved public pensions. And by the way, as we've seen from the recent Great Recession, when stock markets crumbled, RRSPs are notoriously unreliable. Yeah. Unlike public pensions, they provide no guarantees of a given set income. So, sorry to take so long, but that would be my answer to your question.
Well, you need to make your point. But I wanted to say, before I let General answer that question, that the Globe and Mail is the same newspaper that Robert Franklin Williams saw his picture on the front page. Robert Williams from the North Carolina, he had to flee to Canada thinking that he would be safe, and he saw his picture on the front page of that same Globe and Mail. But we wanted to ask Mr. Baker if he could deal with that same question, and I guess it would have the U.S. Would be a little bit different, I presume.
It's quite different. But listen, the same ideological mindset that Brother Bill DeWitt just mentioned exists here too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the most part, in the stateside, all we got that comes anything close to pension is age-old Social Security
mm-hmm.
that was imposed in the states during the 30s under the Roosevelt administration.
The New Deal.
But the whole principle of pensions on this side are not federal pensions. They are not public pensions. They are pensions from based in private corporations, and they are pensions based in states and cities, you know, and that's where most of the pension money comes from. You know, so like as Bill was mentioning, when the crisis took place, the 07 or 08 crisis, as you call it, and all of this money was lost on pension investments into stocks and securities, all of our pensions took a hit. As all of the layoffs increased across the country here in the states, then all of the states who live off of the taxes of the workers that's working, all of that money was lost that went into the state and city coffers. And that's why we got such a crisis on this end with the police and fire departments and all kind of city employees all over the place, teachers and everybody that work for the state or public institutions, all of these attacks taking place on their pensions, health care, and other benefits. In the private sector, most of the private corporations are forcing workers to go into what they call 401ks, or that Bill was referring to as a plan where you pay your own pension and put aside your own money for your retirement. All of these attacks are taking place. But, you know, for us over here, what we're seeing is that they're using this so-called cry of a budget crisis to attack our pensions, to attack the pensions of the entire working class. They even try to divide us over here between talking about the middle class is under attack. We don't have no middle class. We got a whole working class over here. You in the middle of what? But the entire working class is under attack by these corporations that's trying to shift the burden from their backs on ours. And that's the kind of war we're being driven into, and it's ideologically based in what Bill was talking about. These people want to take everything that we have. We have some bills that's been passed here that's so draconian that in Michigan, it's called the Emergency Financial Manager Act, that the governor can send an emergency financial person in to take over your city or your school board and run it in their name. They can dismiss the elected officials. They can eliminate all contracts. It is really draconian. They're trying to reduce us from citizens and make us customers under the automatic thumb of these corporations. And that's the way we see this fight that we're in now. They're just using this budget crisis as an attack to restructure the whole of the entire government and this country and put it under more and more corporate control.
You're listening to CKLN. This is www.ckln.fm, and we wanted to open up the phones very shortly. However, I guess I'm going to ask the last question, and during the question and answer period, we can go into other areas that I know Bill sure. wanted to discuss. But the sure. final question before we open up the phones is, what are the proposals of the CLC for expanding the Canada pension plan, and does the UAW, what is the UAW's plans, or any of the unions in Detroit or in America, what are their plans for helping workers get a fair shake in mm-hmm. terms of their pension okay. plans? I think I'll let General answer that first.
Okay, well, on this side of the border, man, we're really disjointed and really have no overall strategy. All of the unions are coming together. I mean, some of the things that you've seen in Wisconsin, in Michigan, in Ohio, and Indiana, this concentration of this Rust Belt eruption is fighting back defensively. They're trying to stop the cuts and impose taxes on our pensions that's being imposed in each one of these states. But these are being fought back kind of relatively spontaneous with no national plan or no national focus. And the battle is taking place state by state. Meanwhile, Obama is getting a free ride on the top because the budget deficits that's imposed from the federal government only get played out in the cities and states. And that's the kind of battle that we're in right now here, fighting back defensively, that we can figure out an offensive plan to move forward. But right now, we really are being beat back. We're mobilizing. People are getting energized, but we don't have an overall objective strategy coming out of the labor movement, and we definitely don't have one coming out of the disjointed Democratic Party. So we're in bad shape here, but it sets the basis for us to create some kind of new political apparatus that could work out a strategy and could help move us ahead. So that's the kind of framework that this fight is taking place back in the U.S. side.
Now, Bill Devine, could you talk about what's happening on north of the Canadian border? I mean, the American U.S. border. I'm sorry. Pardon me.
Okay, I can try to do that. Can I just make a small point I meant to make earlier? We've talked about the CAW and that I'm a member of the CAW, and I am. Okay. But I should say that I'm today here in my personal capacity only. So that said, the Canadian Labour Congress proposals for a reformed Canada pension plan are threefold. One, it calls for an increase in the old age security and guaranteed income supplement, an increase in those two pensions by 15% each. And the CLC, Canadian Labour Congress, states that this would lift all pensioners above the poverty level. Second, the proposals call for to double the current Canada Pension Plan benefit level from 25% of pre-retirement income to 50%. Now, this would be phased in over a period of 7 years, and it would raise the contribution rate paid by both worker and employer from 4.95% of income to 7.8% of earnings. And as I say, both worker and employer contribute equally. Now, that increase to 7.8% may sound like a lot, but the Canadian Labour Congress has calculated that the initial cost of gradually doubling future Canada Pension Plan benefits, based on 2010 figures, works out to about 9 cents an hour. And by the way, OAS, GIS, Old Age Security, Guaranteed Income Supplement, and Canada Pension Plan are all indexed to the cost of living. On Old Age Security and Guaranteed Income Supplement are adjusted quarterly, while the Canada Pension Plan is adjusted yearly. Now, in terms of contributions, there is an upper income cap. This year it's $48,300, and there is a basic exemption of $3,500. So people pay whatever their earnings are between $3,500 and $48,300. Now, the CLC proposal would raise this basic exemption to $7,000 from $3,500, so as not to disadvantage low-income earners. The Canada Pension Plan is also fully portable throughout Canada. And because the Canada Pension Plan is a contributory plan, it does not add to anyone's taxes. The third Canadian Labour Congress proposal calls for a system of pension insurance for company pension plans so that if a company goes bankrupt, workers would not lose their pensions. Now, until last December, there seemed to be some momentum for an improved Canada Pension Plan along the lines of the Canadian Labour Congress proposals. Provincial governments were on side, and even Finance Minister Flaherty was making encouraging sounds. But last December, Flaherty changed all that. Instead of a reformed Canada Pension Plan, Flaherty proposed a system of pooled registered pension plans, or PRPPs. What these essentially would be is a supersized system of those RRSPs that we spoke about earlier, with all the uncertainties these entail. And participation would be voluntary, not mandatory, as is the case with the Canada Pension Plan. No wonder, then, that Canadian Labour Congress President Ken Giorgetti said, "We were betrayed," which is where matters now stand. But as the Canadian Labour Congress points out, 40 years ago, we won universal health care in spite of opposition from insurance companies and vested interests, with sufficient pressure on government. The Canadian Labour Congress thinks, and I agree, we can also win the fight now for an improved Canada Pension Plan. Again, sorry to take so long, but that...
Bill, that's excellent.
Is there anything else you wanted to add to that, General?
No, not at all. I mean, it just shows you how much further advanced along the Canadian Labor Council is over what we got here on the stateside.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a musical break, and we're going to open up the phones, and the number here is 416-595-1478. That's 416-595-1478. And we're going to listen to Sam Cooke saying a change is going to come.
All
and
right.
I guess it should be I should be speaking in Ebonics, right? But
okay, we're all right.
But we're going to listen to Sam Cooke. And okay. We're going to come back, and you can call Mr. Okay. Baker or Mr. Divine, and okay. We will be right back.
Okay.
Just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother. And I say, brother, help me please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Oh, there have been times
and you're listening to CKLN, and we have on the phone from Detroit General Gordon Baker Jr., and Bill Divine is in the studio here in Toronto, and I believe we have our first caller. Caller, are you there?
Yes, I'm there. How are you?
Good. Did you have a question for the gentleman?
I had a question about the difference between the pension systems between Canadian and U.S. workers.
I'd like General to talk about that before Bill.
Okay. All right. First of all, on the state side, the only kind of national federal pension, I think that he calls it old age pension, that we got here is Social Security. And that Social Security was the Social Security that was passed under the Roosevelt administration back in the New Deal. Most of the people here live off of the private pensions. The corporation that you work under, or the state that you work under, or the city that you work under. Only a narrow group of federal employees get a federal pension. So most of the people here live under private pensions. That makes it a little difficult because a couple of problems arises with that. None of our pensions are portable. By portable, we mean, like, if I work for GM for 5 years and Chrysler for the next 5 years, I can't carry that pension with me. So I have to lose that pension if I change jobs. So your pensions are really stuck in the employee pension kind of systems that blocks us from having real kind of national unity. What we're seeing now in the states is that each of these governors are trying to figure out a way to tax the pensions. And it's the crisis of taxing these pensions that are causing this multiple pileup of unions, not just against collective, fighting back to defend collective bargaining, but to defend your pensions from being taxed by these cities and states and federal government on that level. So those are the kind of differences we got. They're probably more detailed than that about the differences, but I think that's the basic framework that makes us so much different than Canada and so much behind Canada. It's just like we don't have any kind of national health care. We got to get our health care from each company. You know, so we got the same situation with the pensions. I just tried to give you a framework of what the difference is.
And Bill, before you answer that, General is saying that Canada is ahead of the U.S. I guess I take full responsibility for this, but I should open up by saying that Canada is more unionized than the U.S. at this particular point. I think there's only 11% of the working class in America that's unionized, and I think it's 30-something percent maybe in Canada. Is that correct, Bill?
No, it's lower. Well, yes, it could be. In the private sector, it stands around 17%.
Right.
The union density, the number of workers that are organized in the private sector. In the public sector, it's way up to around 85%.
Yeah.
So if you put those two figures together, you could be sort of in the ballpark there at 30% of the total would have the pensions.
Okay.
That is company pensions.
Right.
Now
I wanted you to answer that the same question that I asked General.
Yes, yes, yes. The difference between Canada and the United States.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think General has pretty well covered the situation. It's true. We do have, I guess you'd call it a three-tiered pension setup here in Canada. We've got the old age security and the guaranteed income supplement. That's one. We've got the Canada Pension Plan, that's the second, and there are company pension plans where they exist, so that would be the third element of the pension situation here. But company pensions are very much under the gun nowadays. During those recession years, you may remember that General Motors would have closed up shop had it not been for the government stepping in and financing their existence till they got back on their feet. And that would have meant saying goodbye to General Motors pensions.
Yeah.
Or they would have been reduced drastically, no doubt about it. If I could just say that...
You got your time. You have time. Go ahead.
You have plenty of time. Company pensions certainly can help, if they exist. But, and this is not to quibble, they still fall short. I am, as for company pensions, while they're helpful, but like the RRSPs, they're also not all that reliable, since their solvency is subject to market variations. Also, They are often seriously underfunded. The regulations governing the funding of company pension plans they need to be tightened up a great deal. And if a company goes bankrupt and creditors need to be paid, pensioners go to the back of the line. The banks and so forth come first. Current pensioners may lose their pensions altogether, and future pensioners may have no future company pension at all. Plus, there's something happening here in Canada with company pensions, and it's very worrying. More and more, employers are foisting defined contribution plans on workers to replace defined benefit plans. And just to explain this for a moment, a defined benefit plan establishes a given set amount of pension income that a worker can count on retirement. This is the type of plan that unions have bargained for over the years. However, a defined contribution plan does no such thing. It is an individual plan by each worker and, like RRSPs, subject to the uncertainties of market fluctuations. And it lets the employer off the hook for any pension liabilities. A recent report, again in the Globe and Mail, April the 7th of this year, states that 51% of employers with pension plans have converted from the defined benefit plan to this defined contribution plan. So the trend is established. And to take two big examples, that's what happened in the valet strike in Sudbury, Inco. What they did was. To insist that all new hires go into these defined contribution plans. And the same demand is being made at the steel company in Hamilton, my hometown, where the workers have been locked out for several months. Two demands there to de-index the pension plans from cost of living increases, and also that new hires must go into these defined contribution plans. So sooner or later, if that trend continues, we will no longer have defined benefit plans that, all things being equal, assure a worker of a set amount of retirement income. We'll be saddled with these defined contribution plans that contain no such guarantees whatsoever. It's a very, very worrisome trend that's taking place here. So I better stop there.
And you're listening to Saturday Morning Live online. This is Norman Otis Richmond. I'm on the line from Detroit, Michigan, is General Gordon Baker, retired auto worker from Detroit. And in the studio with me is Bill Devine, who is a retired auto worker from Canada, from Toronto. And is there anything else you'd like to add, General, to that?
Norm, how much more time do we have, Norm? I got kind of an emergency I'm confronted with.
Okay, we have about 5 more minutes. I wanted to ask, could I ask you one more question?
Yeah, sure.
You can answer this. I wanted to know at one point the unions had newspapers, I think a television station, radio stations at one point. Now, with new media like the Internet, I want to get General to answer this question first, then Bill. But
okay.
I think in Chicago you had that was the last time in America that you had like a radio station, maybe a TV station. What is the state of the media, new technology, and TV and radio when it comes to unions? I mean, unions don't have, from what I can see, it's pretty weak.
Yeah, on this side of the border. For so far as radio and TV is concerned, it's almost extinct. The unions are picking up a lot on the social media network stuff. We're using a lot of Facebook, a lot of emails, doing a lot of stuff on YouTube whenever we can. You know, these current campaigns taking place, particularly in the Midwest, are covered. The best way we're covering them now is basically over social media.
Mm-hmm.
Each union still has this national newspaper in the form of paper print, but the social network has really taken over a lot of that. TV and radio media is really almost lacking. Like you can't go to a radio station and pick up the Union Voice. It's non-existent. We don't have it. So we lose a lot of ground on that one, Norm, right now. We got a lot of work to do.
Well, I would like to thank you for contributing on today's show, General Gordon Baker.
Thanks a lot. Hey, listen, I wanted to thank Bill. I got to meet him, man. I really like Bill.
Thank you, General.
All right. I got to learn some stuff from Bill, too.
All right.
And vice versa, let me assure you.
Okay, all right. Y'all take care.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Take care.
All right, signing off.
Okay. All right.
Bye-bye.
And we have been speaking with General Gordon Baker. General Gordon Baker was, now that he's off the air, I can talk about him a little bit. General Gordon Baker was actually went to Cuba and met with Ernesto Che Guevara. And if you listen to Malcolm X's grassroots speech, you can hear General Baker in the background. Malcolm says, "You're afraid to bleed," and General yells back, and I said, we'll bleed. But that's General Gordon Baker Jr. Now, Bill, we wanted to ask you, what is the state of social media in terms of the media and the union situation, TV, radio, and the internet?
It's pretty much the same as what the general described in the United States. I don't know of any union radio stations or TV stations. When it comes to the print media, different unions, some have regular newspaper-style publications. Others have lesser. For the CAW, it has a weekly newsletter that highlights the main happenings in the CAW for that given week. So I think what the general described as the situation in the United States is much the same as it is here. And, of course, the CAW and I guess every other union is on the Internet and on Facebook and YouTube. I'm not sure about Twitter. So that is certainly a growing phenomenon in terms of communications with union members. But again, I'll just conclude by saying that what the general said about the situation in the States, I would say, pretty well applies here in Canada.
Do you feel that the retirees are lacking in, I guess, because of this new technology is new, so a lot of retirees, many of them, not all, don't have the skills in terms of the social media situation. Or like email, many people have email, but in terms of Facebook and Twitter and all of that, I have Facebook. I don't have the Twitter situation. Would you say that there is a problem with the retirees in terms of mastering the new technology?
Well, you've touched a nerve for me personally. I am extremely technologically challenged. I'm not up to date on almost any of the internet, Facebook, Twitter. But that's me. I am actually surprised. You know, we have monthly meetings of our retirees chapter in my local union.
Right.
And we get to discussing the social media, and I'm actually surprised at the number of retirees who have mastered email, computer techniques, Facebook, and all the rest of it. I can't say what percentage of them do that, but in our particular case, our particular local, a good number of our retirees are pretty up to date when it comes to these new technological phenomena.
Well, let me, I don't want to cut you off, go ahead. But I had something to say when you finished.
No, I think I'm finished.
Well, I know that the Toronto Public Library, I'm going to say something good about Toronto right now. Like at the Reference Library and in most libraries, they have classes for, and a lot of them are aimed at seniors and retirees that will teach you the new media. And it's like, really, you can get one-on-one lessons. And I was taught Facebook by a younger person, a young woman who used to work at CKLN from Chile. And, you know, I still have, to a degree, a phobia about computers and things like that. But I think the more, it's like riding a bicycle. The more you do it, the easier it becomes. And once you master it, I think you'll have it down for life. So I think, Bill, I think you should check that public library out, because it would be very helpful.
You've encouraged me to do that, and perhaps I will. I know I should, because otherwise a person is very much out of the loop when it comes to keeping up with events and what's happening and so on. I find that in my case, here's my confession. I don't even have email, mm-hmm. and now everything is email, and I miss a lot that way. So, I will seriously consider. I assure you, I'll seriously consider your advice about taking lessons at the library. Thanks for that suggestion.
I can personally show you how to do the email. Can't do it today because of the time factor. But there is a very good friend of mine by the name of Abdul Al-Kalimat, and he says that if you don't have an email address, that you are homeless. It's like being homeless.
Yes.
Homeless in cyberspace. You really miss a lot, because a lot of the younger people, email is, to a lot of younger people, it's kind of dated, because it's Facebook and it's Twitter.
Yes, this is true.
And things
yeah.
like that. Mm-hmm. So, but an email address is definitely something that you must get sooner than later.
All right. Okay. Thanks for that encouragement. I know you're right. I know you're absolutely right.
Yeah, well, I have some seniority. I know you can. Yeah, you can do it if you worked if you worked at a van plant, you could put that together.
Yes, right.
I think that's a lot harder than pressing the buttons for email.
Well, manually, in terms of manual labor, yes, it is a lot harder. On that assembly line, mind you, I didn't build the complete van, as you probably know. I did one operation. The tedium is involved there when you're doing that one operation, hour after hour after hour. You pray that the line is going to break down, but it seldom does.
Let me say this before we close: that Bob Marley worked was a member of the UAW. He worked at a Chrysler plant in Wilmington, Delaware, and he wrote a song called Working on the Night Shift. That was he was a member of the UAW, so you guys had CAW was formerly the UAW, so
yes,
mm-hmm. you and Bob Marley are comrades.
All right. I didn't know that, but good. Yes.
I'm sorry.
No, that makes me very proud that we are both UAW, CAW brothers.
Brothers in the same lodge.
Yes.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I don't think so. So I'll just say no and let it go at that.
All right. I would like to thank you for coming on Saturday Morning Live today. And we probably should do this again with you in general, because we need, we really need a labor section of this particular show. If we're really serious, we can provide every quarterly, maybe four times a year, you can come on and talk about the labor issues, and we can keep people abreast of what's going on. What do you think about that proposal?
I'd be very happy to do that, and thank you for inviting me today. And if you invite me again, I'll accept.
All right, thank you very much. And we have been speaking with General Gordon Baker and Bill Devine, and I would like to. We're getting ready to pull a curtain on Saturday Morning Live. First of all, I would like to thank myself for doing the technical things today. I shouldn't say myself, but I will also have to thank Chris and Melinda. I would like to thank Bill Devine, General Gordon Baker Jr. I would like to thank Dr. Gerald Horn. I would like to thank Audrey from the Gorilla Crew. I would like to thank Mumia Abu-Jamal. And we will be back next week, and we're going to end with a little Sam Cooke. And tomorrow at 2 p.m., you can hear me on Uhuru Radio. That's uhururadio.com between 2 and 4. I will be interviewing Herb Boyd. Once again, we'll be talking about the new Manning Marable book on Malcolm X. I'll be doing a tribute to the Cape Verde Islands. I'll be playing music from Horace Silver, Tavares, couple of women from the Cape Verde Islands. And I really have to be self-critical because I don't have their names written down and I'm losing my memory. And we also will be trying to talk to Lloyd Price. Lloyd Price he's still in the land of the living. I hope to get him. He lived in Nigeria for about 10 years, and he had a big hit with Stagger Lee. And he was used to work with Don King. He was with Muhammad Ali and George Foreman when they had the Rumble in the Jungle. And he bought the Village Vanguard Club. He has a hell of a story, so I'm hoping that I can speak with Mr. Lloyd Price out of New Orleans, Louisiana. And this is Norman Otis Richmond saying we'll see you in the whirlwind. We're going to end with some Sam Cooke and keep moving on. Take care.
Keep moving on, keep moving on. Life is this way. Keep moving on, keep moving on. Every day. Keep moving on, keep moving on. Life is this way, yeah. Keep moving on, keep moving on. Every day. When I go to sleep at night, I add up my day, trying to recall the things I've done and debts I have to pay. For that is one thing that I know, what you reap is what you sow. Keep moving on, keep moving on. Life is this way, so keep moving on. Every day, brother mine, out what you do and how you treat your fellow man. If you knew like me, you'd try and live the very best you can. For if you spread good all around, you'll be able to sleep when the sun goes down. Keep moving on, keep moving on. Life is this way, so keep moving.